to the latest edition of City Parents Talk. I'm Helen Beedham, Director at City Parents. Today I'm speaking to Christine Armstrong, writer, speaker and business advisor, about being a working parent and her book, The Mother of All Jobs, How to Have Children and a Career and Stay Sane-ish. Christine, thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Did the title of the book come easily?
Well, no, it wasn't my title, actually. So I originally, because I wrote a column about these issues in Management Today, and originally the thing that came out of that was big jobs and small children. And it wasn't big jobs necessarily as important jobs, it was just time-consuming jobs. But publishers really like a kind of a pun, and I think the comparison between me and Saddam Hussein was obviously irresistible to them. So I ended up with the battle of, with the kind of battle talk. So it seems to work. The only thing I regret about it is the word mother, because I interviewed just as many fathers and men during the process as I did women, and so I think, and sometimes I think the title excludes them, so I do worry about it slightly.
Yeah, so your book and what you talk about is really the reality for any working parent.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. But how would you describe your own career and parenting experiences?
Well, I think the most important place to start is that I was an absolute moron. I thought that I would be able to continue my career, which involved a lot of travel and quite long hours, and was very exciting and thrilling, and I really enjoyed it. And I thought I'd be able to combine that with parenting without giving it a huge amount of thought, which I think was incredibly naive and really quite dim. And I sort of saw women around me who appeared to have done that, and I somehow didn't seem to understand, or maybe didn't ask the right questions to understand the struggles that they'd gone through. So I think it was a real shock to me when I discovered that combining my career with small children wasn't working at all. And I did what I now realise lots of people do, which is to turn that on myself and think that I had failed and that I was incompetent, that I wasn't trying hard enough, I wasn't well enough organised, and that I needed to fix everything myself. And that sort of led me to have sort of conversations with other people and to come to a different understanding of the world.
And in your book, or as you approach writing your book, you interviewed many working mothers and fathers about their experiences of starting and bringing up a family whilst pursuing a career. And I was struck by how honest people were about these experiences. Can you give us a feel for some of the main themes that emerged from those conversations?
I think the main feeling is that there is a disconnect between the publicly stated media narrative around working and parenting and the day-to-day reality. And that public narrative comes from very, very high-profile speakers on this subject who are very powerful, very well paid, and have a lot of resource and a lot of help. And there's two things about them. One is, and we'll come back to this later, but one is that if you put people's name and their job title into an interview, and it's very transparent with their colleagues, with their partner, with their bosses, with their clients perhaps, it's very limited what they can say, because you know, you can't talk about your domestic challenges or problems with your kids or, you know, difficulties that you might be having or have had at work if everyone around you is going to read it. And so I think these public narratives by named people who have a disproportionate amount of resource, a disproportionate income, and then also are in some ways perfectly reasonably, I'm not criticizing it because we do protect ourselves, but can't really then tell the truth, leads to everyone else thinking, right, so what I just have to do is get better childcare, and I need to work harder, and I need to lean in, and then it'll be okay. And then when it's not, they find themselves either looking in the mirror if they're on their own, or staring at their partner in the kitchen and going, what have we got wrong? Why doesn't this work? Why is it? What's wrong with us? And I think that that's really damaging and really horrible. So what I wanted to do with this book was to say, look, the world has completely and utterly changed since 1965 or 1970, when, you know, my dad came home for dinner in the 70s and 80s every night at 6 o'clock. Nobody called, you didn't have a laptop, you know, my mum worked locally in teaching, and we were able to have a family life and a family dinner. And now when I interview professional couples, particularly in high-end city jobs, they're online from the moment they wake until the moment they sleep. Probably both of them are working, they're trying to bath the children and be on mute on a call to Singapore, and they're incredibly stressed out about that. And unless we talk about it, we can't change it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that will resonate a lot with our members, because we know from talking to them and our research that, you know, working in the city usually means a really full workload, demanding deadlines, and as you say, with modern technology, an expectation that you can be contactable or available 24/7 or at short notice regardless of where you are. And on one hand, in your book, you describe this as, you know, the explosion of the working day. It's a natural evolution of work life today. But also for those of us that enjoy our work lives, it can feel like an addictive buzz and a sense of achievement and integral to our identity and sense of fulfillment. But on the downside, our time with our children or family can be very limited and feels very precious. So what advice would you have for the best ways of managing those boundaries between work and home and the time that we can devote to our family and friends?
I think you have to be really, really honest about who you are. And one of the things I try not to do in the book is to say there are, you know, silver bullets, there are three things that you need to do, because it very much depends on your personality. And if you are incredibly driven and want to be the managing partner or the chief executive or on the board and have these very big goals, then me telling you that, you know, for some people it works really well to work 4 days a week or to turn their phones off at 6 o'clock isn't going to work for you, because you're going to look at me like I'm nuts. So you have to be really honest about the scale of your own ambition, but then equally, you have to be honest and really forward thinking about, what do I want my children's childhood to have been like? When they account for this later, when I account for it later, where do I want to have been and what do I want to have been involved with? And also to be honest about some of the really difficult stuff. You know, do I feel a bit disconnected from my kids right now? Am I a bit disconnected from my partner? Am I okay with that? And maybe you are, in which case I'm not here to judge. But I think it's being honest about those things. And the people I see getting themselves sort of caught up are people who really do get a buzz out of their career and they love it and they enjoy working hard and they're flourishing and they're earning great money, and you know, that's brilliant, but they know inside that they're also neglecting something else that is important and they haven't found space for that. And so I guess I encourage people to look at that niggle and go, okay, well, what does that mean for you? You know, do you want to be at home with all your devices switched off 2 nights a week? Because if that works for you and you feel happy with that, brilliant, you know, but it's got to be what works for you. And it, for me, it all comes back down to active decision making, because if you let work eat every hour of your day, it will. So you have to be the one to say, okay, that's enough now, you know, the weekend is mine, this day is mine, this evening is mine, whatever, and put the boundaries around it yourself.
Yeah, that's great advice. And you talk in your book about today's child-centric culture and high-pressure parenting approaches. I guess that's often in large part down to the fact that we want our children to have the best possible childhood and give them as many opportunities as we can. But what do you mean by high pressure parenting? How can we be mindful of tipping over into something that might be less helpful to us or our children?
Well, I interviewed lots of psychiatrists and child psychologists and social workers for the book, and also teachers and head teachers. And so one of the messages that comes back from them very strongly is that an enormous performance culture, which we who have worked for 10, 15, 20, 25 years are very used to, isn't that healthy for children. That actually childhood is a time where they need to develop and explore and try things and give things up and fail at things and try something new. And that if we relentlessly apply our own kind of task mindset, driver personalities to them in the hope that they get 3 A's at A level, or, you know, 10 star days or whatever, 9's or whatever we're supposed to get these days, that actually, are we giving them the best childhood? Would they be better off digging worms at the end of the garden or building a hut or painting something or just running around with their mates for a few hours? And I think there seems to me, I'm not a child psychologist, but, you know, reading a lot about it and interviewing those people, it seems to me that we might, in our desire to give our children a great childhood, we might be missing a bit of what childhood's about sometimes. And I think we all see it. I mean, my children are 10 and 7 and 5 now, but my 10-year-old, you know, I really see the ratcheting up of pressure around secondary schools and the exams and the enormous amount of tutoring. And I think we, you know, all of our families have to make decisions about whether that's the most important thing and the most useful thing. I was really struck by somebody who interviewed me, actually, who told me that her friend was a teacher in West London, and the teacher asked a group of reception children what their greatest wish was, and half of them wished that one of their parents would pick them up from school one day. So I think we just have to be really clear about what that good childhood is and what evidence we will take for it later.
Yeah, and would you advocate talking to your children, asking them those kinds of questions, like, if you could change one thing, what would it be,
or I would
what makes you happiest?
I definitely would. I mean, one of the things that lots of people other than me have observed love, but I see for myself now, is that as children get bigger, in many ways they become more difficult to manage. You think when you're in the baby and childhood years that this is the final front, and when you get through it, it'll be better, but they start asking incredibly difficult questions and being demanding in a really good and helpful way that you can't avoid it. You can't avoid these conversations, and great if they initiate it and great if you do. But this morning my 10-year-old sent a text message. She doesn't have a phone, but she has an iPad with text messages on Wi-Fi. And I had a breakfast meeting and I've got a dinner tonight, and she texted and she said, "Mum, what time are you going to be back tonight? Because you said you don't do a breakfast and a dinner on the same day." Obviously I have, and she's totally caught me out.
She's very perceptive there.
So I had to respond saying, "Well, darling, it is half term next week and we've got a week's holiday, so we've got a lot of time together. I will take you to school tomorrow," but I think children find a way to make their case.
Yeah, absolutely. What a great example. And at various points in the book, the theme of people talking on the record and off the record keeps cropping up, and you alluded to this a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Why do you think people find it difficult to be honest about their daily lives and how they're feeling about it? Because, you know, you highlight in your book at different stages of the whole parenting journey, or different career stages, there are some moments where people can feel really quite isolated or down, or be struggling with an aspect of work or home life, and feel unable to share that with others, or feel they have to put up a facade.
I think that this is a generational shift in feminism, and sometimes I get pushback saying that, you know, our generation of women needs to be grateful for the work that's been done by earlier generations in terms of getting women into the workforce at scale, at senior levels, allowing women to be ambitious. And in some ways it feels like breaking the code to then start complaining and saying, well, actually, I don't know that when feminists, you know, wanted to work equally with men, that they were hoping we would also do everything that we did before, as well as working full-time. And that's what a lot of women that I'm interviewing are doing. They are running households and putting in serious jobs and competing in their organisation and feeling insecure about it and working long hours. And I don't think that that's sustainable or ideal for men. You know, I interview lots of fathers who also feel very stressed and frustrated. So I think there has been a bit of a code of silence about how difficult it is. And when I am analytical about it, I say, look at the social changes. So if we go from the 80s and the last 30 years, house prices have quadrupled. We've gone from a world where one income, what would be the dad in those days, could get a house for 3 or 3.5 times his salary. When I say that in the room later, you know, we're talking, people will laugh darkly because that just isn't possible. So we've moved to a world where we need two parents, if there are two parents, particularly in cities, to be working to afford the rent or mortgage. Then we've added always on. Then we've added women wanting to be ambitious and being brilliantly educated and having lots and lots to offer. But we've changed nothing in how we provide childcare, the length of the school day, finishing at 3:15. And so the systems aren't there to support it. You know, 33 hours from the age of, you know, three, but you can't use that money to train, you can't use it to interview. So we're pushing people out of the workforce, they can't afford the childcare. So essentially, I feel we've got a mismatch. It's like tectonic plates. One is going this way, it's very work focused. Another way is going the other way, it's staying completely still. And we need to match them up. I don't think it's reasonable for the government to hold companies entirely accountable for the pay gap when there is no support for early years care, and we have the most expensive care in Europe, and so many women are pushed out of the workforce. And then we say to companies, why aren't there any senior women? You say, well, they've all been pushed out and they can't get back in again. So I think we need to look at the whole system and we need to be honest about it. But I think until now, until relatively recently, there's been a bit of a code of silence, and women have just either given up and gone and been mumpreneurs, or, you know, been freelance, or they've kind of buckled up and got on with it and struggled and suffered. And some of them who I've interviewed have very much regretted some of the decisions they've made.
That's really interesting to hear. And we'll come back to the question of how can we achieve wider societal change around this. For parents that are finding their particular stage of parenting or career a struggle, you do recommend that working parents look for role models to follow. And this is a theme that's come out of our own annual research about the importance of relatable role models. To your earlier point, someone that perhaps doesn't have such enormous finances that they can outsource everything. So how would you recommend people go about choosing a good role model?
I think people should choose role models that they can relate to, exactly as you've just said. So people that they know. I think there's some kind of old culture of, you know, pick somebody off the telly and go, I want to be Fiona Bruce, is nonsense, okay? If she doesn't work in your sector, or he doesn't work in your sector and doesn't understand your issues, is not going to help you. So I think you need to look around you and think, right, who are all the people, they may not be in my organisation, but they may be in comparable organisations, who appear to be enjoying their career and also have a kind of life that looks interesting to me, that I think I could have interesting conversations with, that I can, you know, replicate some of their learnings, and they'll perhaps be honest about maybe mistakes that they've made previously, things that they might have done differently, things that really worked for them. And I think being much more human about that interaction and much more informal. I mean, my book is based on very formal interviews, but it's also based on very informal interviews, you know, chats with people in lifts or at bus stops or on, you know, on the tube, when you just get chatting to someone. Not people do talk on the tube much, but you know what I mean, those small interactions where people share bits of advice and bits of wisdom. So I think the thing about role models, I think sometimes people take the word role model and they apply it to something rather remote and spectacular rather than something very real and tangible and close to them, and that's what I think is really important.
And one of the ways in which City Parents tries to facilitate what you're just describing, looking for role models or people you can relate to, is actually by connecting peers. So rather than aim for someone really aspirational who's at the pinnacle of their career, it's actually finding another mum or dad who's at one of our events who's kind of facing similar issues. And as you'll see shortly in your talk, you know, it's just so reassuring for people to hear someone else put their hand up in the room and say, I'm struggling with X, what's your advice? People email us later saying, it was great to hear that somebody else, you know, has the same challenges as I do. And we hear that a lot from our blogs as well.
I'm sure.
Themes resonating for lots of people. So how can we drive change on these issues?
So I think we've got a number of different things which are making it challenging. One is that we have a very heavy hours work culture, and that's very well established, as you said at the beginning, in city firms particularly. And we also have a culture of not complaining. You know, it's not, you know, it's just not what you do. You just get on with it and take it seriously. And we're quite competitive. We don't want to show any kind of weakness. And we also have a generation of leaders in politics and in business who didn't necessarily struggle with the same challenges. Many of them bought houses when you could buy houses for 3 or 4 times your salary. Many of them have a partner who's based at home. You know, the old breadwinner model, or the one and a half model, where perhaps they've got a partner who works locally or part-time, but, you know, very, very clear division of labour within their household. And now they've got a generation coming through of men and women who not only want to work differently, but have to work differently because they both need to work. And I think that the difficulty is penetrating that top layer sometimes, who don't viscerally understand it in the same way. And, you know, if you think about it in politics, you know, look at Corbyn and Johnson. You know, do we think would they ever actively raise their own kids? This is a completely generation, and I think we see that in politics as we do in business, and it is difficult to penetrate. And one of the things which I've been giving a lot of thought to since the book came out is, why have we been talking about this? And you will have been in the same rooms that I have been in for the last 25 years. We've gone through women in boards and 30% and women chief executives and equal pay, and really very little has changed. And there's a sense, you know, that we haven't achieved as much progress as we should have done, given how much discussion and effort and time and money has been invested in it. My view on this is that we underestimate the resistance to change. And I think of it in an American political model. I did politics at university, but in the political campaign, you have a base. You have people who want to work differently, who know that the way we're working isn't sustainable. They can't be online for 18 hours a day and live healthy, productive lives with caring responsibilities. You have a swing who are managing to make it work, who are interested in the issues perhaps, or perhaps not so much, who just aren't sure what's in it for them to change. It's sort of all right as it is, but might change if they understood it a bit better. And then you have a reach who really don't see the need to change and don't want to change. And the reach don't tend to say very much, because nobody wants to be labelled as a dinosaur, let alone a sexist dinosaur. So I think we underestimate how many people, you know, I see teams go to great trouble and effort and spend, you know, 6 months or a year researching really good flexible working programmes and introduce them. No resistance at all in the business, but they just vanish into the ground when they're launched, and people go back to working their 12-hour days and having team meetings at 6 o'clock and emailing all weekend. And I think that kind of passive resistance to change is what's difficult. And what I've become interested in is, what moves people from one position to another? What is it that changes somebody who is resistant to change or doesn't see the point of it to wanting change and wanting to think about it? And the initial conclusion I've come to from some interviews I've been doing recently is pain. when it causes them discomfort, then they're much more interested in change. And I interviewed a chief executive last week who told me, not that he wasn't interested in gender at work, he's a very open-minded and progressive man, but it just wasn't of primary importance to him until he was leading a global retreat. And right at the end of it, he was very proud of having his team on the stage, and they were just finishing up with some questions, and a woman in the audience put up her hand and said, I just wondered how you felt to have 11 men and one woman on the platform. And he was very embarrassed and very, very uncomfortable and felt terrible about it. And it led him to drive a process of change through the organisation, spend board time on it, to roll it out internationally, to really focus on it. And he says that, you know, the surveys and all the evidence that's really driven change. And it really struck me as a story that resonates with other stories that I'm gathering at the moment, which is there's a sort of moment where people get it, but it's not a comfortable moment. And I think as long as people are too comfortable, they maybe don't change very much.
Yeah, that's fascinating to hear. Thank you. And just to bring our conversation to a close, would you have any closing words of advice or suggestions for any members who might be wanting to rebalance things or reach a better way of managing together with their other half?
I think when I look across the interviews that I've done, there are a number of big themes that seem to, on balance, lead to people being happier in their working lives. But you need to make active decisions about when you want to work, how much you want to work, what you want your lives to look like, and don't fall into things is one of them. The second is to think of your household as one unit. So sometimes people build complexity into their lives inadvertently, and it might be that they create rules that make their lives difficult, you know, what their children will eat or wear or who will take care of them or how things will run, that can actually make life more complicated than it needs to. That can also lead to things like schools or clubs and just, you know, making very complicated diaries, having three different children at three schools, you know, those things. And you've got to look at it as one unit and say, what can we manage that's going to be realistic, and try and reduce the amount of stress and complexity, if possible, that you put into your lives, and be really tough about that. You know, I have a rule now based on my own research from the book. I don't let my kids go to clubs unless they can walk to them, just because I can't manage to drive three different kids to three different places three nights a week, and stick to those rules once you've made them. Another big one is about money, and this is a tough one because sometimes people sort of wince because they're already halfway down the line with this. But if you set your household budget when you go into parenting at a sustainable level that allows you to increase or decrease your work as you go through and your partner, so that you can work maybe 4 days for a while, maybe you can finish early for a while, and then you can go back to full time, and you can flex according to your family's needs and your partner if you have one's needs at that time. That's hugely liberating. And the people that I see are really, really stressed are people with big mortgages, big car bills, and schools is the really, really big one, where they just feel that there's just no slack at all for them to, you know, take the foot off the pedal and be a bit more present at home for a while, or maybe just take a bit of a break, quite honestly. And so I really encourage people to be pretty brutal about their household finances and not too aspirational, because it's very easy to, you know, get wrapped up in we need the biggest house and, you know, all those sort of things and the best schools, and that can, I think, lead to a lot of challenges later.
Yeah, it is amazing how quickly complexity grows in your family setup and how quickly you become used to it and kind of take it as a given.
One of the things that I find is when I say that to people, they often say, I just can't make those changes, it's not possible. And that's fine, you know, people have to make their own decisions. But what I often then find is if I go back 6 months or a year or 18 months later and see that person again, often if it's really intolerable, something will change. They will perhaps lose a job, or a partner will lose a job, a child will have a particular problem that needs special attention, there'll be a marital rift. I find when people are under a huge amount of pressure and think they can't change anything, that something usually happens and then everything changes, and suddenly that unlocks it and everything's able to resettle. And what I try to say to people, which probably doesn't work, but I'll air it anyway, is if you cannot get to the crisis but make changes before, that's clearly better.
Christine, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you for sharing your stories and advice with us. And thanks to all our listeners too. If you'd like to find out more about City Parents, please follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram or Facebook, or visit us at cityparents.co.uk. And stay tuned for more from City Parents Talk coming soon. Goodbye.